World Health Organization Infection Control Webinar Series, The Modern Approach to Infection Control, presented on the 16th of February, 2010, by Professor Didier Pitté on behalf of the WHO First Global Patient Safety Challenge. World Health Organization First Global Patient Safety Challenge. Clean care is safer care.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second webinar of the World Health Organization. Thank you for being with us today. Well, I would say this afternoon in Geneva, but this morning in the USA and in Canada, and at night for our friends in Hong Kong, as well as very, very late in the night in our colleagues and friends in Australia. My name is Professor Didier Pitté from the Infection Control Program at the University of Geneva Hospitals, and I will be delivering this lecture today for you. Lecture entitled The Modern Approach to Infection Control. So let's move to our second slide for today, which is my usual slide, Welcome to the Hospitals. Infections are waiting for you at the entrance door of the hospital and will certainly complicate your hospital stay. As you know, infections are very important. They complicate between 8% and 12% of hospital admissions in the developed world, and the rate of infection is much higher in developing countries. But the problem is not new. Here is a picture of Florence Nightingale in the 19th century. Florence Nightingale, who wrote her book, Notes on Hospitals, that was published in 1863, where she nicely described the architecture of hospitals. She also described the patient chart, which is on this next slide. And in this very interesting book, she has a famous sentence, which is, the very first requirement in a hospital is that it should do the sick no harm. Really a testimony to the fact that healthcare-associated infection are a major problem and were a major problem at this time already for patient safety. But among those pioneers were others, including Ignaz Philipp Semmelweis. You are certainly all aware about the story of Semmelweis and this one of his particular and phenomenal intervention. Here is the next slide, which shows the maternal mortality rates in the first and second obstetric clinics at the General Hospital of Vienna between 1841 and 1850. You probably remember that the first clinic was where, in red on the slide, where the maternal mortality rate was much higher, was the clinic where medical students and physicians were delivering the babies, and simultaneously, or in between babies' delivery, were also giving birth to the mothers that were coming to this clinic, which was the major obstetric clinics, not only in Vienna, but probably in Europe and certainly more wider space. And as you can see, in the second clinic, where only midwives were delivering the baby, the maternal mortality rate was much lower. As you certainly know, Semmelweis had the feeling that the cross-transmission between the autopsy room, where only the physicians and the medical doctors were performing the autopsy, and the delivery room, where medical students and physicians were delivering the babies, were cross-transmitted in between the ward via the hands of those healthcare workers. And he imagined, and this is the next slide, to introduce hand hygiene using a chlorinated lime solution that was poured into this hand wash basin, in order to probably or possibly stop cross-transmission between the cadaver particles in the dead bodies and the woman coming to the clinic to deliver their baby. In the next slide, you have the results of this intervention that was effective on May the 15th, 1847. And as you can see, rapidly, within the same year, the maternal mortality rate went down to, let's say, normal, equaling in the first and in the second clinics, despite of the fact that medical students and physicians continued to deliver pregnant women in the first clinics and only midwives in the second clinic. This is a very important intervention that definitively marked the first intervention at a large scale and also a randomized approach to this intervention in infection control. These were the early times of infection control, as suggested by the next slide. One single physician, then one single nurse, then as this single nurse working very closely to William Farr, the first registrar of England, who discovered all sorts of epidemiological relation or even epidemiological actions or interventions that could be performed in order to reduce infections and harm to the patients. What are the lessons to be learned from those pioneers? Actually, those pioneers teach us that we have to learn how to recognize the problem, to explain the problem, and then to act or to intervene in order to tackle the problem. Now, importantly, the next slide is asking an important question. Does infection control control infections? Because if we have no argument that infection control would control infections, then we are out of job. Now, one of the very first and important study, as you know, is the SENIC study, the study on the efficacy of nosocomial infection control that was published in the American Journal of Epidemiology in 1985. In this study, the investigators actually studied infections, and on this graph you will see relative changes in nosocomial infection rates in a 5-year period between 1970 and 1975 in two groups of hospitals. In one group of hospitals, the first group, where there was no infection control. This is to say without infection control. And as you can see over this 5-year period, it appears that infection rate was on average increasing by 18%, whereas it was an average, and that lower respiratory tract infection increased by 9%, surgical site infection by 14%, UTI by 19%, and bloodstream infection by 26%. That's on average 18% in those hospitals without any infection control. In parallel, in more than 100 hospitals with infection control practices, you see a reduction of 32% in the average rate of health resulted from the reduction in pneumonia, surgical site infection, UTI, and bloodstream infections that range between 27 and 35%. So importantly, the difference between hospital without infection control and hospital with infection control, the net difference was 50%, so a 50% reduction in the infection rates. Now, this study is extremely important, and in this study you can read also an extremely important parameter that is summarized on the next slide. In the analysis of the study, the investigator nicely highlighted that to explain for the efficacy of infection control, you have essentially four independent parameters. The first was that hospitals had one infection control nurse per each 200 to 250 beds. Nowadays, we know that this number should be around one infection control nurse per each 100 to 110 beds. Second parameter was to have one hospital epidemiologist per hospital for a 1,000-bed hospital. If your hospital is larger, you probably need more. Third parameter was to have an organized system for surveillance of nosocomial infections in your institution. And the fourth parameter was to feedback the rates of nosocomial infection rates to healthcare workers and in particular to surgeons in this SENIC study. Now, what we also learned from this SENIC study is the change in actually the team to do and conduct infection control. We moved from a single nurse, from a single physician, to a team for a 1,000-bed of 5 infection control nurses and 1 hospital epidemiologist. And nowadays should be probably for a 1,000-bed hospital around like 8 to 10 infection control nurses and probably 2 hospital epidemiologists. Now, the concept and the approach to infection control, as you may agree, has evolved. Now, we also learned from the CELIC study the very first principle of infection prevention that is shown on this slide. This is to say that at least 35 to 50% of all healthcare-associated infections are associated with only five patient care practices, which are use and care of urinary catheters, use and care of vascular access lines, therapy and support of pulmonary functions, surveillance of surgical procedures, and hand hygiene and standard precautions applied at the patient point of care. Let's come back on these five major patient care practices, and let's review today where we are in those five items, and also take this opportunity to review the guidelines for prevention as well as the very last papers that appeared in the literature over the past several years that definitively are breakthrough information in the field of those prevention strategies. Let's speak first about use and care of urinary catheter. On the next slide, a summary of healthcare-associated urinary tract infection epidemiology. Urinary tract infection causes around 40% of all hospital-acquired infections. Most infections are due to urinary catheters. 25%, it is to say a fourth, of inpatients in hospitals are catheterized. And this UTI leads to increased morbidity and cost. There have been guidelines, and this is the next slide, in the UK, in the USA, and in Europe and Asia in order to prevent healthcare-associated infection, and in particular, urinary tract infection. The next slide said a very simple concept. Prevention of catheter-associated urinary tract infection relies on two main principles. Avoid unnecessary catheterization and limit the duration of catheterization. So importantly, the next slide shows indications for the use of indwelling urethral catheters that has been summarized in the paper in Ishii in 2008. The indications are perioperative use for selected surgical procedures, urine output monitoring in critically ill patients, management of acute care urinary retention and urinary obstruction, assistance in pressure ulcer healing for incontinent resident. And as an exception, really an exception, sometimes at patient request to improve comfort, but I would say that in principle, you should not accept these as an indication. Urinary incontinence is not an accepted indication for urinary catheterization. Thus, between 21 and 50% of urinary catheters are not indicated. And this is a very important parameter for prevention. On the next slide, I ask the question, is one catheter better than another? In fact, there is no significant difference between latex and silicone catheters. What about coated or impregnated catheters? The idea or the concept is prevention of biofilm formation, and on these slides there is an electron microscopy picture of biofilms on silver-coated catheters. Now importantly, here is a meta-analysis of the possible role of antimicrobial coated urinary catheters. Proportion of participants or of catheters developing catheter-associated bacteriuria are summarized on these slides. And actually, currently, you can say that those catheters are not recommended by any of the guidelines. There is insufficient evidence and their cost is probably too high. These catheters may have some effect, but studies are mostly of poor quality. Maybe they could be useful in high-risk groups only. Catheter insertion and maintenance may be of some problem. Practice hand hygiene is definitely important. You should do it before insertion of the catheter, before and after any manipulation of the catheter site, and according to the 5 moments for hand hygiene that is promoted by WHO. This is in particularly true also for the after body fluid exposure risk. important now is discussed about catheter insertion and maintenance. Guidelines are here listed and ranked according to their level of evidence. Insert catheters by use of aseptic technique and sterile equipment, cleanse the metal area with antiseptic solutions is unnecessary, routine hygiene is appropriate, properly secure indwelling catheters after insertion to prevent movement and urethral traction, maintain a sterile, continuously closed drainage system, and do not disconnect the catheter and drainage tube unless the catheter must be irrigated. The next slide continues with the recommendations for catheter insertion and maintenance. Maintain unobstructed urine flow. Empty the collecting bag regularly using a separate collecting container for each patient, and avoid allowing the draining spigot to touch the connecting container. Keep the collecting bag below the level of the bladder at all times. Do not routinely use silver-coated or other antibacterial catheters. Do not screen for asymptomatic bacteriuria in catheterized patients. Do not treat asymptomatic bacteriuria in catheterized patients except before invasive urologic procedures. Well, important is to say what you should not do to prevent catheter-associated urinary tract infection. First, do not use or really avoid to use catheter irrigation. Second, do not use systemic antimicrobials routinely as prophylaxis. And third, do not change catheters routinely. Well, after I showed you all those guidelines, I would like to summarize for you one study that we conducted that is summarized on the next slide, which is showing the incidence of urinary tract infection before and after a multimodal intervention that we conducted, and over a two-year period, we had a pre-intervention and a post-intervention period. And as you can see, first line overall number 35 and 13, as well as overall incidence density of urinary tract infections expressed by episodes per thousand catheter days, were reduced overall from 27 to 12 for a 55% reduction overall. But it was mainly due to the reduction that was observed in the orthopedic surgery department, that was the intervention group, where, as you can see, the incidence density was dramatically reduced as to compare to an incidence density that was relatively stable in the control group, which was in this study, the digestive surgery group. What did we do in this study? And this is the next slide. Reduction of UTI and antibiotic use after surgery. It was a control prospective before-after intervention study. The incidence density of UTI decreased by 60% after orthopedic surgery following a multimodal intervention that was very easy. First of all, just make sure that the indications for catheter use were clear and precise, that the catheter would be removed as soon as possible, and that there will be no use of catheter for no reason. The results were maintained after 2 years. There was less indwelling urinary catheter placed in the operating room, and we also monitored a decreased UTI antibiotic-related consumption, as well as reduction of resistance in our institution following this intervention. Basically, this intervention, as you may all understand, was a multimodal intervention strategy that works perfectly well at reducing urinary tract infection. Let's now move on the next item, which is use and care of vascular access line. As everybody knows, vascular access line are the sources of catheter-associated bloodstream infection, whether the source would be intraluminal from tubes and hubs, whether it would be extraluminal from the skin sites of the patient, or whether it would be hematogenous seeding from distant sites. Reported incidence of rates of catheter-associated bloodstream infections in surveillance networks in intensive care units are shown on this slide. First, the National Healthcare Safety Network, the rate is 2.7 per 1,000 catheter days. The Michigan study, 2.7 again. In Germany, the KISS system, many different hospitals, 2.1 per 1,000 catheter days. There is also data from the International Nosocomial Infection Control Consortium, INIC, between 2002 and 2007 from 18 developing countries. And as you can see, the rates are much higher in those developing countries, 8.9 per 1,000 catheter days. So definitely a very frequent and very important problem in healthcare settings. What about the prevention of vascular access line infection? I will show you an intervention that we made in intensive care at the University of Geneva hospitals. Education-based multimodal prevention strategy of catheter-related infection. For those who are interested, we published the details of the intervention in the Sepsis Monitor in the year 2000. What did we do? We actually used all the guidelines that were in the literature and made sure that all the items that were items for important infection prevention strategy would be applied at the point of care. The next slide shows the prevention of vascular access line infection in the medical ICU expressed as incidence density. So this is to say episodes per 1,000 patient days between 1996 and 1997. As you can see, we observed a marked reduction in primary bloodstream infection, clinical sepsis, microbiologically documented bloodstream infection, as well as insertion site infection. The paper was published in The Lancet in 2000. Importantly, at the same time, we look at others, the experience of others published in the literature speaking of education-based prevention of vascular catheter-associated bloodstream infections. And here are rates expressed as primary bacteremia per 1,000 central venous catheter days. The experience by Bob Sherratt, by Copper-Smith, by Warren, and by ourselves, Eggman and colleagues, are all the same. We obtain a reduction in primary bacteremia in all sites. When we look at our rates, 5 years later, in 2002, and published those rates in the Annals of Internal Medicine, Eggman and colleagues, in 2005, you could see that we had a continuous impact with the strategy. When we tried to compare our rates to rates that were in the literature, in the NIS, the National Nosocomial Infection Surveillance System, in 112 medical ICUs, in 146 surgical ICUs, you can see that the rates after the intervention were markedly reduced and markedly lower than the average rates in the NIS system. And this is to say that average rate is not necessarily the best that you can get in healthcare-associated infection prevention, which was the motivation for us to go ahead and implement those strategy and continue to implement those prevention strategy on catheters. As everybody understood, these strategies are multimodal intervention strategies to reduce catheter-associated bloodstream infections. They were composed of hand hygiene promotion, the use of maximal sterile barrier precaution at insertion, skin antisepsis with alcohol-based chlorhexidine-containing product in most of the studies, the use of the subclavian access as the preferred insertion site, the daily review of line necessity, standardized catheter care using a non-touch technique, and the respect and respecting the recommendations for dressing change. For those interested, you can read the three references that are provided at the bottom of the slide. Importantly, what were the efficacy of those multimodal intervention strategies, speaking of rates? First line, Eggman paper in The Lancet, and then in 2005, follow-up at 5 years in the Annals of Internal Medicine, baseline 3.1 per 1,000 catheter days, following intervention 1.2. The Pronovos paper in the New England Journal in 2006, very high rates at the beginning, after the intervention 1.4. the paper by Walter Tsing in Critical Care Medicine published last year, 3.1 at the beginning, 1.1 per 1,000 catheter days after the intervention. Very low rates. The next slide, could we do better? Very recently, the use of chlorhexidine gluconate impregnated sponge has been added to this multimodal intervention strategy. And the next slide shows chlorhexidine gluconate impregnated dressings that decreased major catheter-related infections, as you can see in the chlorhexidine dressings versus the control dressings on these Kaplan-Meier cumulative risk curve, and as rates going from 1.4 per 1,000 catheter days only to 0.6 per 1,000 catheter days. And the paper was published by Jean-François Timsit and colleagues in JAMA in 2009. The next slide shows the efficacy of multimodal intervention strategies summarized on the previous slides, adding the study by Jean-François Timsit published in JAMA in 2009. So if you want me to use a wording that is frequently used, yes, we can. Even we had a multimodal intervention strategy that reduced catheter infection rates in the range of 1 to 1.4 per 1,000 catheter days. The group of Jean-François Timsit in these multi-center studies that I recommend all of you to read went even further down, up to 0.6 per 1,000 catheter days. Now, if you understand this message, it is very clear. Speaking of prevention of vascular access line infection, again, the strategy is a multimodal strategy as nicely depicted earlier for urinary tract infection prevention and now for catheter-associated bloodstream infection. Let's move now to the next and the third principle of infection prevention, which is working on therapy and support of pulmonary function. As you know, risk factors for ventilator-associated pneumonia, VAP, are many. They are in the range of the patient site as well as in the range of the device site. Now, importantly, general precautions are staff education, hand hygiene, isolation precaution, very high grade of evidence, surveillance of infection and resistance with timely feedback, and adequate staffing level, which is extremely important in the ICU. The next slide shows you the effect of staffing level in the late onset VAP that we published in Critical Care Medicine 2007, and that clearly demonstrate that if the nurse-to-patient ratio is below 2.2, unfortunately, we observed an increased risk and proportion of infected patients. Now, obviously, as you all well understood, the endotracheal tube is a major problem for healthcare-associated infection. Intubation and ventilation. If you want to prevent infection, avoid intubation and reintubation. Prefer non-invasive ventilation. Prefer orotracheal intubation and orogastric tubes. Continuous subglotting aspiration is important. Maintain cuff pressure above 20 cm H2O2. Avoid entering of contaminated condensate into the tube or the nebulizer. Use sedation and weaning protocols to reduce duration and use daily interruption of sedation and avoid paralytic agents. Is there a role for oral antiseptics? Well, when you look at the meta-analysis of the possible role of oral decontamination using chlorhexidine, it is clear that, yes, there is a decrease in the relative risk for infection on average, despite of the fact that there is no impact on mortality according to this meta-analysis. Now, is there a role for oral antiseptic? Well, maybe oral chlorhexidine application reduces VAP in one study, but not for general use according to those guidelines. You will see later that probably the place for chlorhexidine is much larger than assumed in those guidelines in 2005. Systemic and enteral use of antibiotics. Selective decontamination of the digestive tract, the so-called SDD, reduces the incidence of VAP and helps to contain multi-drug resistant outbreak. But SDD is not recommended for routine use. What about prior systemic antibiotics that helps to reduce VAP in selected patient groups but increase multi-drug resistance? Well, only to be used in selected patient population. 24-hour antibiotic prophylaxis helps in one study but not for routine use again. So again, there are many different situations where you should debate about those techniques. Stress bleeding, transfusion, hyperglycemia, I think that trend toward less VAP with sucral fat versus other H2 blockers, but increased gastric bleeding, so this is to your choice. Prudent transfusion, leukocyte-depleted red blood cell transfusion, intensive insulin therapy to keep glucose level between 80 and 110 milligram per deciliter. What about aspiration, body position, semi-recombinant position between 30 and 45 degree, especially when receiving enteral feeding is recommended. Enteral nutrition is preferred over parenteral because of translocation risk, and this seems to be very important. But before I end with this general conclusion about the prevention of VAP, I would like you to concentrate on this study that will be reported and will be published very soon in Critical Care Medicine. A multifaceted program to prevent ventilator-associated pneumonia impact on compliance with preventive measure by Lila Boudma and colleagues, this multi-center study. What did they do? They insist on eight different parameters in order to improve these adherence with hand hygiene, adherence with glove and gown use, backrest elevation maintenance, correct tracheal cuff maintenance, orogastric tube use, gastric overdistension avoidance, and good oral hygiene, in particular using chlorhexidine, as well as elimination of non-essential tracheal suction. You should really read this paper. They improve compliance with all these practices in a two-year intervention study. Compliance, again, with practices, preventive measures increased, and in the meantime, VAP prevalence rates decreased by 51%. A very important key paper that is really, to me, a breakthrough paper in the literature. So to summarize VAP prevention, I would say hand hygiene before and after patient contact, preferably using alcohol-based hand rubbing. Avoid endotracheal intubation if possible. Use of oral rather than nasal endotracheal tubes. Minimize the duration of mechanical ventilation. Promote tracheostomy when ventilation is needed for a longer term, and glove use and gown for endotracheal tube manipulation. Avoid non-essential tracheal suction, oral hygiene with chlorhexidine, backrest elevation between 30 and 45%, maintain tracheal tube cuff pressures greater than 20 to prevent regurgitation from the stomach, avoid gastric overdistension, promote enteral feeding and careful blood sugar control in patients with diabetes, and think about SDD in selected cases. As you may understand, again, a multimodal intervention strategy to succeed at preventing VAP in hospitals. Let's now move on the fourth of the very important care practices to reduce healthcare-associated infection prevention, which is to say the experience with surgical procedures. As you know, surgical procedures are at risk for surgical site infection. The objective of prevention here are to reduce the inoculum of bacteria at the surgical site using surgical site preparation, antibiotic prophylaxis strategies, optimize the microenvironment of the surgical site, and enhance the physiology of the host or the host defense, if you like. And in relation to risk factors, you can classify those as those that are patient-related or so-called intrinsic risk factors, as well as those which are preoperative and operative. I will have no time to go in details over these, but I would like to give you a few caveats speaking of prevention. Let's give patient-related factors, diabetes, recommendation from IDSHA, preoperative, control serum glucose level, and they give you some range. Postoperative, cardiac surgery patient in particular, maintain the postoperative blood glucose level at less than 200 milligram per deciliter. Smoking. What is the rationale? Nicotine delays wound healing. Cigarette smoking is an independent risk factor for surgical site infection after cardiac surgery. And of course, this is without telling about the risk for pneumonia, which is certainly much higher among smokers than non-smokers following very important and major surgery. Of course, there is no study to really demonstrate the benefit of stopping smoking before a surgery, because you should probably stop several years before. But the recommendation is definitive smoking cessation, if possible, within the 30 days prior to the procedures. What about operative procedure-related risk factors? There are many, as you know, hair removal technique, on pre-operative infections, on surgical scrubbing, on skin preparation, on antimicrobial prophylaxis, on surgeon skill and technique, on asepsis, on operative time, the shorter the better, on operating room characteristics. Obviously, I will not be able to review all these information in details, and I will just pick up a few of them. Antimicrobial prophylaxis, for example. What are the recommendations? Administer within 1 hour of incision to maximize tissue concentration. Once the incision is made, delivery to the wound is impaired. Duration of prophylaxis. Stop prophylaxis within 24 hours after the procedure, within eventually 48 hours after cardiac surgery, in order to decrease the selection of antibiotic resistance, to contain the cost, and to limit the adverse events. And those are key parameters to actually follow. Those are parameters that are included in the surgical safety checklist to reduce morbidity and mortality in surgery that is published. And I recommend to you to read the paper in the New England Journal of Medicine of the second WHO challenge, where you have the signing, the timeout, and the sign-out part of the surgical safety checklist. Surgeon skill and technique is definitively, of course, very important. Excellent surgical technique reduces the risk of surgical site infection. And include many different advices that senior surgeons would emphasize to their junior fellows once they are performing surgery, and everyone should be very aware of these. Active surveillance. And I'm sorry, here I realize that the slide is in French, but very easy to understand. Active surveillance is a very key parameter for infection prevention. As you can see here, for three large, very large surveillance systems, PRESIES, published in International Journal of Quality Health Care, KISS, published in ISHE in 2006, and the French system in CISO, published in Journal of Hospital Infection in 2007, very, very large number of patients, very long time period between 4 and 6 years, as you can see, and very marked reduction in infection rates, possibly resulting almost only from the active surveillance and report to the surgeons of their infection rates, with reduction between 25 and 57% of surgical site infection rates. This next slide shows you, in summary, relative risk reduction for surgical site infection resulting from active surveillance between 38 and 55%, as I just say, from multimodal intervention, from correct and timely antibiotic prophylaxis, from normotemia, normoglycemia, in two different studies, published respectively in the New England Journal of Medicine and in Journal of Hospital Infections, from the role of chlorhexidine alcohol preparation for surgical preparation, which is relative because in the study published recently in the New England Journal of Medicine, it was compared to iodine instead of being compared to an alcohol-based preparation of iodine. But still important to keep in mind. Supplemental, the role of supplemental oxygen that needs to be also further delineated. The role of nasal mucosal methicillin-sensitive Staphylococcus aureus infections. I recommend you to read and access the paper in the New England Journal of Medicine published at the beginning of this year. And what about surgical hand antisepsis? So far, no data, but I can tell you that there is equivalence between surgical soap, between medicated and non-medicated soap, as well as alcohol-based hand rub. While The take-home message of this slide, again, is very simple. As you can see, those are techniques that are effective and that are multimodal. Again, you should use a multimodal strategy to prevent surgical site infection. And on the next slide are examples of multimodal approaches to reduce surgical site infection. Timely antibiotic prophylaxis, strict glycemia control, no shaving in the study published in the American Journal of Surgery. Surgical site infection is 1.5% versus 3.5% in control. The 100K Lives campaign, antibiotic prophylaxis, glycemia control, normothermia, resulting in a 27% reduction in surgical site infection rates. So importantly, again, multimodal approach to prevent surgical site infection resulting from surgery in healthcare. What about the last but not least patient care practices? Hand hygiene. As you know, compliance with practices is very low, most of the time below 40%. As you know, hand washing with soap and water is to be considered as an action of the past and should be replaced by alcohol-based hand rub as standard of care, which is system change in hand hygiene promotion. Again, we recognize the problem, we explain the problem, and let's act at changing the practice of healthcare workers. We use simple educations in Geneva, simple education technique to promote alcohol-based hand rub. We use the walls of the hospital to educate the healthcare workers. And as you know, using this multimodal strategy, we improve compliance with hand washing at the point of care, and in particular, with hand rubbing. We, in parallel, monitor infection rates, hospital-wide nosocomial infection rates, trends between 1994 and 1998, and they were reduced by 50%. So, tremendous impact of these multimodal intervention strategy. When we look at our results in an 8-year follow-up, we published it in ISHE in 2004, and definitively not only showed the efficacy and the effectiveness of the strategy, but also the cost effectiveness of this strategy. Now, what were, from this success story, the key parameters for success? They were system change, education of healthcare workers, monitoring and feedback of their performance, strong administrative support, leadership and culture change, and it was associated with reduction in cross-transmission and infection rates. These five core components of the WHO multimodal hand hygiene improvement strategies were system change, education and training, performance and feedback, reminders in the workplace, as well as promotion of hospital safety climate. And as you know, they were transformed into an implementation toolkit in order to help and promote hand hygiene in healthcare setting using these tools. Among those tools is the My 5 Moments for Hand Hygiene tool, these 5 moments that will change healthcare practices at the point of care, that these are the major time where healthcare workers should perform hand hygiene before touching a patient, before clean aseptic procedure, after body fluid exposure risk, after touching a patient, and after touching patient surroundings, even if they haven't touched the patient. Again, this strategy was a multimodal intervention strategy, with the 5 components being system change, being education of healthcare workers, being monitoring performance and feedback of this performance, being reminders at the workplace, and being the promotion of the safety culture in the institution. So to conclude with hand hygiene promotion, I would say that again, we have all the evidence to say that using a multimodal intervention strategy that accumulates system change, education of the healthcare workers, reminders at the workplace using monitoring and feedback of the performance, as well as reminders in the workplace, and promote the culture of safety in your institution, is definitely a key for hand hygiene promotion strategy worldwide. Let me now, in the conclusion of my talk, summarize for you what are to me the evolving to new challenges in infection control and patient safety key parameters. As you may well have understood from my lecture, multidisciplinary teamwork is critical in infection control, as well as the conduct of successful interventions. Actions should be adaptable, because adaptability of actions is a prerequisite for the endorsement of the action and the adoption of the strategy for change by healthcare workers. Then, scaling up strategies are key and critical so that the many more patients can benefit from the very few interventions that have demonstrated to be efficacious in healthcare-associated infection prevention. Then we should ensure suitability of actions and interventions and sustainability over time of those actions and interventions. And for these, we also need strong leadership commitment, and we need governance from the highest level in order to succeed. Importantly, as I told you, infection control and quality healthcare in the new millennium is a multidisciplinary team approach. We started from the very top of the pyramid to know the more enlarged base of the pyramid that include a multidisciplinary teamwork. Multidisciplinary teamwork which is to be included into our perspective of the future. Where are we going? I can certainly tell that in the field of infection control, we will work with people in state and country epidemiology program. We will speak at international surveillance system level. We will work with financing bodies. We will work with patient safety promotion at every level. We will also work at healthcare system level, at the level of hospitals, ambulatory services, nursing homes, long-term care facilities, home care delivery systems. It's important to realize that we will definitely be connected with many others in the field. As you understand, it is summarized by multiple task activities, multiple partners, multidisciplinary team approaches, and multimodal strategies for infection prevention. I don't want to finish my lecture without reminding all of you about the 5th of May. We want people to access and join us in the Save Lives initiatives. You should all join us aiming at having more than 10,000 registered healthcare facilities by May the 5th, 2010. Save lives. Clean your hands. We are around 6,000 healthcare facilities, and the countdown has now started to reach 10,000 healthcare facilities participating into the Save Lives initiative on the next 5th of May. Save lives. Clean your hands. 5th of May 2009 to 2020 will be WHO Patient Safety Initiative, where we all will continue to encourage healthcare facilities to show their commitment to clean hands by signing to this website. So please sign now, but we'll come back on this concept soon. Patient safety, infection control at the point of care. WHO Patient Safety Initiative, WHO collaborating centers, country campaigns activities, facility campaigns activities, including evaluation and feedback. All of these save lives, which is the ultimate goal that we all have in infection control, as well as, and this is my next and last slide, make sure that healthcare is safer worldwide. With these, I would like to thank you for your attention. I will be more than happy to answer to the questions that, again, has to be submitted to me through the webinar system. Thank you very much for your attention. I will now start to answer to your questions. I have received many different questions. The first question is coming by Carlos Milan. What are the basic difficulties to reduce urinary tract infection? Well, I think it's an excellent question that you are asking, and the most important and key concept, as you may well understand, is to reduce the use of catheter. As I say, there are two major action to reduce urinary tract infection, which is reduce the use of urinary catheter and reduce the duration of use of urinary catheter. It's clear that if you respect the indication for catheter use and also shorten as much as possible the duration of catheter use, you will have a marked impact on urinary tract infection. Let me remind you that between around 20 to 50% of all catheters used in hospitals are used for bad reasons. So it means that you could certainly easily decrease the number of catheters by a third or by even 50% using very simple actions to reduce their numbers and also their duration. Now, it is clear that once you would have been reducing those catheter use, you will not certainly have a zero level of urinary tract infection, and that you will have to work on different other parameters, including clean insertion and all the parameters that I have been reviewing a little earlier. Practice adequately hand hygiene before and after catheter care, clean the meatel with antiseptic, and properly secure the indwelling catheters. Do not disconnect the catheters and drainage tube unless the catheter must be irrigated, and so on and so on. Another question that is coming from Naga Kamis: what would be the technique for oral antisepsis using chlorhexidine to help in prevention of VAP? Well, I think that it's difficult to answer to this question on a webinar, but clearly if you access the different studies that look at the use of chlorhexidine as oral hygiene in the literature, it is fully explained in the methods of the papers. What is usually done is that you recommend nurses at the time that they are performing oral hygiene, ensuring the maintenance of the orotracheal tube, to clean the mouth of the patient 4 to 6 times a day with chlorhexidine containing product. And I would encourage you to look at the literature for the exact description of the when and the how to use this oral hygiene product. But it is clear that, as you know, orotracheal tubes have to be taken care of by the nurses in the ICU. This is an important part of their work. They have to do it very, very properly, and once they do it with a chlorhexidine containing product, it is clear that the contamination of the mouth is reduced, and because of this, there is less microaspiration of microorganisms along the orotracheal tube, and it has been proven to be quite efficient as one of the strategy within the multimodal infection prevention strategy to reduce VAP. Another question that is regarding, do you recommend catheters with antibiotics or antiseptics for high-risk patients? Now, I suppose that this is catheters that are IV catheter, intravenous catheters, because that's what I understand from the question. This question could be asked for all the devices. They could be asked for IV devices and also for urinary tract catheters and for orotracheal catheters. For urinary tract catheters, I gave the answer in my lecture. The answer is no. There is no benefit from antibiotics or antiseptics impregnated catheter, including in a meta-analysis that I summarized for you. For orotracheal catheters, we still don't know. They are currently not recommended. They are now used for in several research trials, but so far there is no answer. Now let's come to IV catheters. IV catheters could be coated with antiseptics or with antibiotics, and with different antiseptics. It could be silver, it could be chlorhexidine, it could be many other antiseptics. It could also be covered by antibiotics. I did not review this literature for the purpose of this lecture, mostly because this would be reviewed in the next webinar by Dr. Walter Tsing that will be given on March the 16th. So I would encourage you to attend this webinar and to get the answer to this question. The next question that I received is from Tara Francis, and the question is there any difference using chlorhexidine containing or non-containing alcohol-based hand wraps for hand hygiene? This is an excellent question. When you talk about alcohol-based hand wraps, when you consider the alcohol-based hand wraps, the first and most important thing and parameter to consider is their content in alcohol. There are two types of alcohol that you can have in those alcohol-based hand wraps. Either you have isopropyl alcohol, and in this case you should have at least 75% volume of isopropyl alcohol, or you could have ethanol-based alcohol, and in this case you should have at least 80% ethanol alcohol in the product for the product to be efficient. And it is this concentration of alcohol which are the most important. Now, in some of those alcohol-based hand wraps, you could have an additional component, which would be, for example, chlorhexidine. In the literature, both in the laboratory and in ex vivo studies, it has been demonstrated that the colonization of the hands of healthcare workers at the point of care when the alcohol-based hand wrap contains chlorhexidine is reduced, so is slower over time by a significant amount. Whether this benefit is possible to be demonstrated in a clinical effectiveness study is another issue. So in other words, speaking of efficacy in the lab or in an ex vivo study, yes, you could demonstrate the beneficial addition of chlorhexidine to alcohol-based hand wrap preparations that are already of optimal use. But whether this has any clinical significance remains to be tested in a controlled study in an institution where compliance with hand hygiene is already good or even better than good, let's say around 60, 70, 75 or even 80%, in order to really demonstrate the potential additional benefit of the addition of chlorhexidine in an efficacious alcohol-based hand wrap. So I will recommend you to read the WHO guidelines where this has been addressed in order to make your own decision whether you have to choose an alcohol-based hand wrap, for example. This is not the only parameters to choose an alcohol-based hand wrap, as you may understand. Tolerability, acceptability being also very important parameter after you have been making sure that your product is effective and efficacious in the laboratory. I will now move to another question. Could the hand hygiene compliance monitoring be simpler or more simple to be more effective in developing countries? Well, so far, the gold standard technique and the gold standard approach for hand hygiene compliance monitoring is direct observation of the healthcare workers when they are practicing healthcare or patient care. Whether you are in a developed or in a developing countries, the technique is always the same. You go at the bedside and you monitor healthcare worker practices and you quantify using the standard approach that we have been developing and universally used at WHO to monitor hand hygiene practices. So in other words, the technique is the same whether you are in developed or in developing countries. The gold standard is still the monitoring of hand hygiene practices by direct monitoring of the practices using ideally the five moment tools that have been developed using the recording tools that we have developed at WHO. You should access the website, you should access the instrument, you should access the toolkit that we have been developing in order for you to be able to monitor these practices at the point of care. And whether you are working in a developed or in a developing countries, this will still be the same, exactly the same approach to monitor hand hygiene practices. And then you should be able to retrieve the overall compliance with the practices, to retrieve the compliance according to the 5 respective moments for hand hygiene, to retrieve the compliance for physicians on average, for nurses on average, for other healthcare workers, and eventually to compare the average compliance rates between different wards at your institution, provided your sample size is large enough. For those who are interested, please access our tools in order to be able to access the practices of hand hygiene monitoring. Another question, is there an upper limit which the vascular access line should be changed as a routine? Well, this is again an excellent question. There are actually several studies in the literature that early demonstrated that you should not introduce a routine change. Your question is challenging. Is there an upper limit? So could you leave a line as long as you want? Well, again, I don't think that this is an answer that I should give today. I would encourage you to come on the next webinar of the WHO, where you will have answer to these questions regarding the duration of catheter use. Next question is from April Rates. Well, she gave me a comment first. I will read it. It's embarrassing, but this was one of the best webinars I have ever seen. I would love to have the slides. Thank you very much. As I said earlier, you could get the slide tomorrow. Tomorrow you could get access all the slides coming on our webinar website, and by accessing the slides you could get also the audio tape. I would be pleased if you can use those slides for promotion and for education in the future. And thank you for your comment. Next question. The question is, can the urinary catheter be clamped for some time? Does it increase urinary tract infection? Well, this is an excellent question, of course, and again, we are not into a specific seminar on urinary tract infection prevention, but yes, as you may understand, clamping of the urinary catheter makes problems somewhere, somewhat it could increase the risk for infection. It is clear that in some situation you have to clamp the urinary catheter. For example, when a patient needs to be moved from his chair to, let's say, his beds, or when the patient has to be moved and where there is a risk for urine to go back in the patient, you should of course be extremely careful. So that's why one of the recommendations is keep the collecting bag below the level of the bladder at all times. Now, there may be some conditions. For example, when the patient is moved into the radiology department to get a CT scan and the patient has a urinary catheter in the bladder, in this case, of course, you should clamp the urinary catheter. And in this case, you try to clamp it in order to make sure that you won't have the collecting bag above the level of the bladder of the patient. So in this case, of course, yes, you should clamp the urinary catheter, but you should try to clamp it for as short time as possible in order to make sure that you don't induce a retention of the urine in the bladder, which would certainly, after some time, increase the risk for urinary tract infection. So I would say, yes, it could be clamped, but for a time that would be as short as possible. I will now take another question. Do you have any educational facility program for hand hygiene? and to prevent infection in school systems. So do we have any educational program for hand hygiene? The answer is definitely yes. Yes, we have all those tools that we have developed for hand hygiene promotion and that proved to be efficacious and effective once we tested those strategies in healthcare settings. And we have tested those strategies in multiple healthcare settings, in multiple cultural environments, in developing and as well as in developed countries, in university hospitals as well as in district hospitals, and so on and so on. We have not so far developed a strategy on school system. We have recommended the use of alcohol. As you know, there has been preliminary results and several studies demonstrating the benefit of hand hygiene using either hand washing with soap and water or using in particular alcohol-based hand rub in school systems. There has been report about their efficacy. There has been report on the reduction in cross-transmission of infections, whether it will be upper respiratory tract infections or diarrhea or digestive diseases in both developed and developing countries. Now, unfortunately, so far, there are no tools that are universally available to promote hand hygiene in school systems, but I guess that those tools will be certainly developed and available very soon in order to make sure that we could also improve hand hygiene in those environments that are so important nowadays to infection transmission. In particular, as you know, it has been one of the key strategies to reduce the transmission of H1N1 in schools during the H1N1 pandemic, and it has been proven to reduce cross-transmission and also probably to be of really important benefit in this strategy of the contention of the H1N1 pandemic. Thank you for the question. It's clear that we need further material to be developed in this field. Before speaking to the next question, because we have had several questions on urinary catheter infection prevention, I would say that I would remind all of you that we will have a webinar on urinary tract infection prevention that would be at the same time at 3 p.m. in the afternoon on October the 19th. October the 19th. I will go now and take the next question. Is there any evidence of benefit on infection when involving in the program patients and visitors? Thank you for these questions. This is an excellent question. It is clear that there would be tremendous impact of patients participating actively in their own safety. If you can imagine, for example, for hand hygiene, that when a healthcare worker is coming to take care of a patient, the patient would be able to remind the healthcare worker about the importance of hand hygiene and to eventually even participate into improving hand hygiene compliance by healthcare workers. This would be absolutely great. Nowadays, there are some programs, and in particular, Marianne McGugin in the United States is using this strategy. It is used in the UK, Clean Your Hand program. It is used and tested also here in Geneva. It has been used in Saudi Arabia. It is clear that patient participation may help. The way you should help patient to participate, the way you should encourage patient to participate, the way you should explain these to nurses and physicians are not clear so far. So it is to say that the perfect system to help you to introduce this patient participation and also eventually visitors' participation into hand hygiene promotion are not clear. But definitely they need to be studied, they need to be investigated, and we need to get the results of those investigations in order to give very simple action items so that people could use them. Whether it has been used for other infection prevention, yes, it has been used for surgical site infection prevention in some centers, They are widely promoted. The patient is coming to the hospital, is reminding the nurse about the importance of the preoperative showers, is reminding the surgeon about the importance of antimicrobial prophylaxis, is reminding the surgeon about the importance of making sure that he would do the best that he can. And I think that these are very important parameters. It is also clear that in some institutions, patients are actively engaged in the hospitals in prevention strategies that are developed in the hospital to prevent healthcare-associated infections. So in some hospitals, patients' advertisers, patient representatives are part of committees that are setting up guidelines for preventions in their own institution, prevention of bloodstream infections, prevention of surgical site infections, prevention of pneumonia, prevention of urinary tract infections, and so on and so on. So it is clear that patient participation will be more and more important in the future. But as I said, so far we don't have the tools, the definitive tools that patients should be given, and tricks and tips that we should be given to healthcare workers and to patients, so that this collaboration and active participation could benefit the patients. I will now move to a next question, which is from Gary Kelly. Alcohol concentration matters, but the US is looking for guidance. Most practitioners in the US feel your recommendation for high alcohol, 80% ethanol or 75% isopropyl alcohol, is only for the third world facilities. Why can't WHO be more forceful? Well, that's an important question. It's clear that WHO has been traditionally worked for many developing countries. So it's clear that when WHO issued guidelines, it is frequently addressing the needs of developing countries. But in this case, for hand hygiene, the WHO guidelines for hand hygiene promotion are actually guidelines that have been developed for developing and developed countries. And a multimodal strategy has been developed at the University of Geneva Hospital and Clinics, which is in Switzerland, which to my knowledge is a perfectly developed country. But then the strategy has been universally used and developed, and this is used in developed and developing countries. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have asked us at WHO to provide a document to explain what are the differences between the CDC guidelines and the WHO guidelines. The WHO guidelines have been tested, they have been validated, they have been retested and revisited and revised, they are based on evidence, they have been submitted to peer revision, and nowadays they are of course more advanced than the previously published CDC guidelines in year 2002. And it's clear that the recommendations for better and more efficacious alcohol-based hand rubs is highlighted in those guidelines and are extremely important. Now, what could WHO do to be more forceful to implement more widely those guidelines in the United States is something that we should bring to more discussion. We are trying to promote those guidelines worldwide, and it's unfortunate that in the United States there are still institutions that are using less efficacious products than you could find in many other places around the world. And I can only agree with your proposal of making sure that those guidelines are widely disseminated and widely understood for the benefit of the U.S. healthcare system and the patients admitted in U.S. hospitals. Thank you for the question. I have a question that is relatively related. Where can I read about the hand hygiene observation tool? Has the tool been tested? Yes, of course. And this would be the topic from another webinar. But clearly, if you access the WHO website, if you access the 5th of May website, and I'm now showing on the website the address of the website, www.who.int, and then gpsc/5th of May. By accessing this website, you could access every single tools. We have developed more than 40 tools for hand hygiene promotion, and among those tools are hand hygiene observation tools, hand hygiene observation manual. There is also a DVD that explains to you how to monitor hand hygiene practices according to the 5 moments, and so on and so on. So I will recommend you to access this material. A related comment from Tara Francis. I have used the hand hygiene WHO guidelines and toolkit, and I used it for training and also of trainer programs. It's very, very useful and encourages all nurses to use it. Thank you very much, Tara Francis. I'm coming now to another question. Question is, surgeons in developing world have mindset of overusing antibiotics. What would you suggest? Well, thank you for this question. This is an excellent question. It is clear that in the developing world, you know, some surgeons are anxious about the conditions where the operative procedure has been conducted. They may have patients at very high risk for infections, patients that are very, very sick, and they tend from time to time to overuse antibiotic in those conditions. I think that this is true, and this is something that should be really addressed with appropriate studies and should be left to the evaluation of the surgeon at time of surgery. Let me remind you that what is important for surgical prophylaxis is all what is happening from the beginning of the skin incision to wound closure. All what is happening in before and after that time is not related to surgical prophylaxis. So I think that surgeons, and including the surgeons in the developing world, should really consider this again and again and again. And if they could restrict the antimicrobial prophylaxis to the restrictive use that we try to have in the developed world, it would be for the best, definitively. But I agree that in some conditions, when they have doubts about the way the sterilization procedures were completed, for example, or when there are other conditions that may facilitate infection, increase the risk for surgical site infection, actually surgeons may decide otherwise. But it would be important in this case to document what's going on, because what we still need are studies that not only demonstrate the benefit of early identification of problems, but also of the fact that the surgeons are sometimes left on their own for this type of decision. I would recommend, in conclusion, to follow the guidelines as much as possible and to consider any events that occur during the operating procedure in order to answer to the possibility or the eventuality using the antibiotics for a few more days as originally thought of. Next question that I have is, are there any studies regarding the effectiveness of non-alcohol-based hand rub? Well, that's an excellent question. I could answer very easily to your question because you say effectiveness. Effectiveness means that you have reduction in healthcare-associated infection rates. So to answer to your question is very easy, no. There is absolutely no study using non-alcohol-based hand rubs that have proven effectiveness. So it means reduction in healthcare-associated infections. Now, there are some non-alcohol-based hand rubs that are tested currently in some laboratories with, I would say, some efficacy. Some of those products have very low efficacy, but very, very low efficacy, and some of others have efficacy that is a little higher, but so far have never seen any non-alcohol based hand rub that matches the efficacy in terms of effectiveness or immediate efficacy among non-alcohol based hand rub or products. Some of those products have efficacy on the long term, which is actually not that much of a good strategy in the field of hand hygiene, because those products need to be efficacious immediately at the point of care, as soon as it has been used. So, as you may understand, unfortunately, many of those products are not effective when they are non-alcohol based hand rub immediately. They are sometimes effective within minutes and some more than several minutes, which, as you can know, is not enough. Alcohol based hand rub are effective and efficacious within seconds, which is the key reason, in addition to their very high efficacy in the range of 4 to 5 to even 6 log reduction. And these are the major argument for now to continuously recommend alcohol based hand rub and no other product for hand hygiene. We are now coming at the end of our webinar. It was a great pleasure to answer to your questions. I would remind you the next webinar, which is on the 16th of March, which will be addressing the prevention, the epidemiology and prevention of healthcare-associated bloodstream infection. The webinar will be given by Dr. Walter Tsing from our team, and it will be a very important webinar because, as you may know and recall from even my lecture, healthcare-associated infection, bloodstream infections are very important infections in terms of frequency, but in particular in terms of morbidity, mortality, and extra cost associated with the infection. So I could only recommend all of you to join the next webinar on March the 16th at 3 p.m. Geneva time, as well as, of course, and as suggested on the slide, join the initiative Save Lives, Clean Your Hands on the 5th of May 2010, where you will be encouraged to monitor hand hygiene. Every hospital is participating, and there will be more than probably, hopefully, around 10,000 hospitals around the world will be monitoring hand hygiene practices all together, and also monitoring in a framework that we have developed specifically for the next 5th of May, a framework of monitoring the way and where is your institution on the way toward becoming a hand hygiene excellence center. So I would really encourage all of you to join simply by accessing our website, again, www.who.ent/gpsc/5th of May, so that you can access all the tools that we have developed for hand hygiene promotion, as well as the new tools that we have developed for the next 5th of May. With these, I would like to thank you all for your careful attention, for all those questions that you have been submitted to us. I will encourage you to access the website tomorrow so that you can get all the slides as well as the audio recording of this webinar. Thank you very much for participating, and talk to you soon.